Bud Wilson on November 7th. Okay. Trying to put this in a little, another context. In Wyoming, you had no, I guess there weren't Indians to deal with up there.
Well, there was an Indian reservation.
Was there?
Nearby the Arapaho reservation near Riverton.
Mm-hmm.
But we could never, we tried to employ Indians best we could, but we're never successful there. Of course, at the Navajo mine, we entered into a contract with the Indians to give the Navajo Indians preferential hiring rights. You know.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, we had about 60% of the force was Indian when we started.
At the Navajo.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think now it's almost 100%. Yeah.
Hmm. About the environmentalists at that time?
The environmentalists didn't become significant until probably in the 70s. The 60s, maybe there was some concern, but it did not impact on the mining industry until sometime in the 70s.
Opposition to the nuclear power began. I think there was this Clamshell Alliance, and I saw the date for that the other day. I would think that was in the 60s.
Well, I suppose so.
67, I think.
But that didn't impact on the company. And I think the first time that we became aware of problems of potential problems for environmentalists was after the Navajo mine was in operation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, then the problems became significant, and one had to learn to deal with them or go out of business.
There was a lot of opposition down there in that area.
Yeah. There were so many things going on in a relatively short period of time, it's hard to keep them.
I know, it was a complex period.
We had Lucky Mack, we brought Shirley Basin on about the same time that the Navajo mine came on stream. We were planning another coal operation in Colorado.
What was that?
That was the Trapper mine.
Oh, yeah.
That probably came into being in the late 60s. Then we were beginning, we were putting the Mount Goldsworthy mm-hmm. joint venture together about the same time.
How did that come about?
The state of Western Australia asked for bids, tenders, on this iron ore deposit called Mount Goldsworthy. And it was just a small mountain sticking up out of the Western Australia desert that was hematite. And West Barre was in charge of exploration in those days, and he learned of the request for tender sent sent over a man out to Western Australia, and then Homer went to Japan and visited with George Ishiyama, who by that time had an office in Tokyo, and to explore the possibility of long-term sales to Japanese. The company learned that Cyprus was also bidding on the job, on the deposit, and suggested to Cyprus that rather than compete, we might work together. Cyprus had had another had gold fields, Consolidated Gold Fields of London, was also considering tendering, and it was through Cyprus that the Goldfields had brought into the three-way joint venture.
And they were already in the Marcona.
We were already at Marcona.
Together.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
Pima.
And Pima. We haven't talked about Pima, but
no.
That, well, so the three companies bid on Goldsworthy, were successful.
Was that with the Australian Commonwealth government?
Or no, that's the state of Western Australia. In Australia, the states own the minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And, in each of the areas in which we became involved, we negotiated with the states for the right to.
And each state has its own ministry of
yep.
mines.
Yep. Where were we?
You,
now, you gotta keep this thing on track.
Well, huh? We're doing all right. It's you know, it's terribly complex. You were saying that at this time, in addition to Navajo, you had Trapper and Mount Goldsworthy, and then we got off a little bit on Mount Goldsworthy, but it was apropos of the Navajo.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps we've said, I don't know, have we said all you want to say about Navajo? You stood up for using drag lines, and
yeah.
you won that.
Yeah.
And you were dealing with the Navajo culture, and you said that ultimately you had 100% Navajo employees there.
Well, I was guessing, because
right.
I haven't checked that
no,
now.
No, but nearly. And then I kind of got you off the track with the environmental question, and did you have to deal at all with the state of Arizona? The Arizona Public Service, is that a...
Arizona Public Service Company was the power,
a private company,
the electrical generating publicly owned company based
okay.
in based in Phoenix.
Phoenix.
Yeah.
Did you have any dealings on a political sort of level with Arizona?
Not with Arizona. No, we did in New Mexico.
Mm.
The Indian tribes have significant rights on the reservation as opposed to the states. So our having contracted with the Indians for the lease had some effect of insulating us from state politics. But we became were pretty significant as far as the state was concerned. And maintain, you know, good relations with the state government.
Actually, Four Corners has four states in it.
Yeah, of course, we were located in New Mexico.
I see. But on federal land, so to speak, Indian land.
On Indian land.
They contract directly with the federal government, don't they?
No. No, they should just simply exercise the rights granted them by the treaties that were entered into long ago. And
so they're sort of exempt from some of those state laws.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You had only one fatality. That's a pretty good record.
Well, I'm not suggesting that was the only. It's the only fatality that I can remember. Mm-hmm. There may have been others, but
it's been a long, successful operation.
Yeah, it's been a good, profitable operation. The contract with the Arizona Public Service has been negotiated, renegotiated a number of times. And it's interesting that mine started out as providing the lowest cost fuel in the western United States, and now it is one of the highest cost fuels. The large coal deposits have been opened up in Montana, South Dakota. Natural gas prices have declined, so it no longer has the economic advantage that it did, but it's still a good, solid operation.
What kind of coal was it?
It's a sub-bituminous coal.
Sub-bituminous, okay. How much are these know next to nothing about economics, but cost and pricing are affected by taxes and other government decisions, subsidies, and that sort of thing. It isn't always straightforward to assign a cost to some of these things.
Well, and you're thinking about the
were there subsidies attached to
no these. Subsidies. No. No. Utah financed the development of the mine. Arizona Public Service contracted to the extent that their electrical energy charges were influenced by the state.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about shipping? How was it shipped?
Well, see, the power plant was built right at the edge of the mine.
That's right. You didn't have to ship any coal.
So we built a railroad to move the coal from the various pits. So the mine was strung out over several miles. We used the railroad to haul the coal in, dump it in the coal stockpile. Then the coal was reclaimed and pulverized and blown into the boilers in the power plant. So it's really a pretty direct operation.
Mm-hmm. Aside from the shovel versus dragline decision, were there any technological decisions that you had to make?
Oh, some, yeah. Having to do with the reclamation of the coal. But it was all pretty simple. It was not pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Not terribly significant. Rod Hunt continued to head the design division. He and I had a falling out over selection of some of the equipment. Rod wanted to install a coal reclaiming device that had been newly designed but had never been operated, never been put in production. So I I disagreed with his recommendation and put something in that I had seen operating back in the East and I knew would continue operating. Well, that was a pretty bitter pill for him to swallow.
What
he finally left the company over that argument. Yeah.
What was the
Well, it's a reclaiming device. He believed would be the new design would be more efficient. And I, by this time, I had been so impressed by the need to be darn sure that everything worked at this mine that I wasn't about to put anything new in. Untried. Because we had a penalty clause in the fuel agreement with the Arizona Public Service that was very significant because they had a $200 million power plant sitting there. If we didn't perform, you know, their investment would have been for naught. So had we been unable to perform, it would have been extraordinarily costly to us.
So you didn't dare take a chance on anything you tried?
No.
What did you learn from this?
What did I learn from it?
From the Navajo.
Well, I suppose I learned a lot of things. I learned a lot about people and I learned a lot about strip coal mining. What else did I learn? I don't know. An incident kind of taught me why the Indians lost the big war.
What was that?
Raymond Nakai wanted to shoot wanted to go to Wyoming and shoot an antelope. So I got, I sent him his license and later called his secretary to be sure the license had arrived and she said, yes, it's on his desk right by his telephone. I sent the Utah airplane in to pick him up and bring him to Wyoming. Had dinner that night and I said, Raymond, you have your license? Oh no, I forgot it. I had to send the airplane back to Navajo that night to get his doggone license and bring it out by sunup the next morning.
Oh dear. Did you go hunting with him?
Yeah.
Did you get an antelope?
Yeah, he got an antelope. Uh-huh. Sure. But that was a pretty expensive antelope.
We haven't mentioned your hunting. When did that all, were you hunting at this time?
When I had time, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was pretty busy.
I would think so. It doesn't sound as if there was much time for play.
I would go deer hunting in Wyoming with Lowell Moorfelt. Somebody else whose name has escaped me now.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of fun, but nothing serious. But just after the Navajo began to operate, you know, relatively trouble-free, we began to get involved in Australia through this Mount Goldsworthy operation.
Is this a time to bring in Pima before we do Goldsworthy? Or?
Sure, we can go bring in Pima. We're backtracking again, but
yeah, this might be a time to. Down in the southwest, anyway.
Yeah. I have to think a little bit about. How Utah acquired 25% of Pima. That was before my time. And I guess that was kind of a quid pro quo falling out of Marcona. Cyprus was the lead in Pima. And Cyprus brought Utah and Union Oil Company in. Utah 25%, Union 25%, Cyprus 50.
Union wasn't in any of these other things.
No,
this was just Cyprus with Pima. And Pima was copper in southern Arizona.
Yeah, Utah did the stripping and built the surface facilities at Pima.
But it was a separate corporation.
It was a joint venture.
Or
it was an unincorporated joint venture.
Okay, a separate, the operation.
All right, maybe we can start that thing
okay,
again.
Okay, I had left it on, I'm sorry. Is that all right?
Oh, that's right,
yeah.
Sure.
It's just as easy to let it run.
Yeah.
So, what was your involvement with that?
I had only one. I did a feasibility study for Christensen that led to Utah's acquiring that 25% of Pima.
How did you do that? You went down and visited it, or?
No, I did it all at my desk in San Francisco.
At your desk,
yeah.
Okay.
I had the technical information. Perhaps I didn't go out to Pima. I'm not sure.
I have trouble with feasibility study. The term, I always think somebody would do a feasibility study very early in the game, but evidently it comes sort of later.
Well,
when does
you have to develop the feasibility study, the estimate on which the decision to invest in something or not invest comes after all of the information has been developed. So in sometimes you can spend a heck of a lot of money developing that information before you get to the point where you are able to decide. Yes or no, and that's some of the, well, that's the effort to try to take the risk out of an investment.
So these other people had collected a lot of the information.
The geologists, mainly geologic information. That's the important thing. Developing a go, no-go decision in a mine is the grade of the ore and its cost of extraction. When I did this study, I had all the geologic information available to me and the construction division's estimate of the cost of building the facility, so it was pretty easy.
Mm.
Info was all there.
This is in 62, I think. That's what my notes say.
No, I think it was before that.
You must have done the feasibility before that.
That was done in the '50s.
Okay. 62 is when I think they started up.
Yeah.
First ore was shipped in 66.
Milled.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no, the copper concentrate was shipped.
This is the first time that you had dealt with copper,
yep.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Anything different about that?
Nope.
No.
Different chemical characteristics and different metallurgical treatment.
Right.
But to a young metallurgist who thought he knew everything, it was pretty simple.
And you recommended that it was a good one?
Oh yeah, the feasibility study proved to, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Define the thing as an attractive investment, and it was.
Did you have any difficulty putting that over?
Christensen put it over. See, I was, but when I did that, I was still a junior engineer,
okay.
And the board was something that met in a corner office in
mm-hmm.
the boardroom, in which I was not involved.
You just passed it on up to Christensen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my involvement with Pima then, over the years, was just simply that of Utah's representative on the Pima board.
That was later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But after I did that feasibility study, and during the time that the construction folks were busy stripping and building down there, I had nothing to do with Pima.
I see. Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with Marcona at this time?
No, I didn't. Nothing. By that time, I think Chuck Robinson had left the Utah offices and built a separate organization.
But Christensen was, well, Chuck Robinson was.
Chuck Robinson was a Utah employee whom Christensen put in charge of the Marcona joint venture. And Cyprus desired a more separate desire to separate the management of the joint venture, which it was involved, from the Utah management, so it was set up as a separate organization.
Mm-hmm. And that was Cyprus and Marcona and Goldfields?
Mm-hmm. No, that was Utah and Cyprus.
I mean Cyprus.
Utah and Cyprus.
Just the two?
Yep.
Okay, all right. And there was some equity participation.
Yeah, Alan Christensen had something like, I forgot now, 2 or 3%, and one of the Cyprus people had a like amount.
I have a couple of names here, Harlan Walker and E.R. East.
Harlan Walker was the manager of the Peruvian operation. He was sent down there as a mine manager.
Mm-hmm. And E.R. East.
Hmm?
East?
Henry East.
Henry.
Henry East was in a Peruvian government.
Oh.
And was hired by Marcona. I think Henry had worked in the mines department or some such a thing.
And Bunker Hill was, did you have anything?
No.
Utah acquired, bought Bunker Hill.
No, Utah. Utah negotiated for the acquisition of Bunker Hill, but backed away at the final, the last minute. Never, no, Utah did not acquire Bunker Hill.
Oh, they did not?
Nope.
Oh, I thought they did.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that must have been in the 60s also, huh?
Well, I had 67.
Yeah.
I thought they bought it.
No.
Mm. Okay. So, I thought that would have brought you full circle. Back to the Bradleys.
Yeah, would have. Mm-hmm. Back to the Bradleys, but.
And now Ladd Petroleum, I guess, is later.
Ladd was acquired in the 70s.
Yeah, so you weren't in that yet.
Well.
Or were you?
The acquisition of Ladd Petroleum Company was really Ed Littlefield's decision.
I see.
In the 70s, it was, the security analysts were pushing companies to diversify. Diversification was the cry. And, if you had a lot of money, you ought to buy another company. So that kind of propelled Utah into the petroleum business in a small way.
It already diversified into mining.
Yeah. So the time we acquired, we're getting ahead of the story, but the time we acquired Ladd, we were heavily involved in Australia, and more than three quarters of Utah's profits were coming out of Australia. So there was really a significant motivation to try to get something going someplace else.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should leave that for a little later then.
Yeah, I think we ought to develop the Australia story.
Okay, I wanted to just divert into Pima for a little bit and then go to... So, Mount Goldsworthy, did you have anything personally to do with the Goldsworthy?
Yes, I did,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was Utah's
talk about
man on Goldsworthy.
You were?
Yeah.
Okay. Assigned by?
Beg pardon?
Assigned by Christensen still?
By Littlefield. I think by this time Christensen was gone. And I think Christensen was gone. Ed Littlefield was now president and general manager of Utah. The title we used in those days.
You became executive vice president in, you became president in 1970. I've got too many timelines going here.
I've forgotten it too.
You went up through a lot of different kinds of vice presidency.
Oh, yeah. Those days, you know, Utah, the old construction company, had junior vice presidents and senior vice presidents. And,
let's see. You were a senior vice president by 1964. You were a senior vice president. One of four senior vice presidents in 1964.
64,
is that right? You've only been with the company 10 years and you were already a senior VP. Yeah, there were four of you, Albert Reeves, Frank Keller, Charles McGraw, and you.
Yeah.
And it presumably was alphabetical order. No, yep. I guess not. Reeves was senior vice president and secretary.
Yeah.
And then the others are in alphabetical order, so you're always at the bottom of the of the list. If your name were Anderson, you'd be number one, I guess. You were executive vice president by the 1968. In 68, you were executive vice president. Ed Littlefield was president and general manager. You were directly under him as executive vice president. And you were also a director.
I think I was chief operating officer.
Just as executive vice president. And you were a director also.
Yeah.
In 64, I think you were not a director. No. The board of directors was enlarged considerably by Littlefield.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line.
Before Littlefield, the board was made up, for the most part, of descendants of the founding families.
Now, all the names
the Brownings, the Eccles,
Dees,
Kimball,
Wattis, they're all that same little group of people.
Then when Littlefield became chairman, he brought in Ernie Arbuckle, who was then dean of the Stanford School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
And
Brandon is a new name.
Yeah, Brandon was manager of, the business manager for Stanford University. And we had brought Brandon in to take over, to help with the land development business that we had.
And you, those were the three new ones, Arbuckle, Brandon, and you.
Yeah.
At that time.
Uh-huh.
Now the land, all that land development was going on independent of you, right?
Yeah, it was. That was Frank Keller was responsible for that. And
that was a big activity of Utah.
It was, yeah. It didn't make any money, but it was sure a big activity.
By 1970, R.J. Miller had been added to the board. He was another Stanford.
Yeah, see, R.J. came out here. R.J. was president of Ford Motor Company. Came out here when Ernie Arbuckle was killed in an automobile accident. R.J. took over dean of business school following.
Well, now in the 1970 list of directors, it has both Arbuckle and Milner. But
that's right, yeah.
And you and Brandon. I mean, those are the four new names in addition to all the old Shepard Mitchell, he'd been on a long time. Was he one of them?
Shep Mitchell was one of the descendants of the founding family.
Okay. So the four new ones in 1970, there were Arbuckle, Brandon, R.G. Miller, and you.
Mm-hmm.
And all the others were the Eccles, Browning, D. Eccles, Kimball, Littlefield, Wattis, Reeves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were the brash youngster, the new blood?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. And you were executive vice president by then. And Christensen had gone.
Yeah.
Okay, so Goldsworthy, when did you first go out to Australia?
Maybe it was 61. Going to Australia was quite an adventure in those days.
Yeah.
You know?
How did you go?
San Francisco to Honolulu, overnight in Honolulu, then to Nandi in the Fiji Islands, overnighted there, and then into Sydney the next day.
Didn't fly at night?
Well, no, they didn't. See, they had this Boeing double-decker propeller-driven aircraft.
Mm.
And they take off with two crews. And I think it took 8 hours to get to Honolulu. So,
Boeing double-decker.
Oh, yeah, I've forgotten what they called
it. I don't remember. Huh. Well, it was a lot easier on your body to do it that way
sure
than it
was.
Is now.
Yeah. Then shortly after that, the jets, the 707s, took over.
It's faster, but it's murder on you.
Yes, I made the first trip to Australia because of Goldsworthy. I went out to Port Hedland.
Which Utah had built?
No.
Hadn't
they? No, Port Hedland was an old town, sort of a town that was supported by the cattle and sheep. Ranching in the area. And boy, was it a backward place. Well, it had a little hotel, and the ship would come in, I think once every 2 weeks from Perth. And there was an airfield there. We flew up from Perth in a DC-3. And that plane went on to went on someplace, I guess, on up to the north. Go stay in a hotel, he'd invariably get into a bed that somebody had just left to get on the airplane. And, oh God, it was terrible.
Mm.
Hot.
How did you get from Sydney to Perth? That's a long
aircraft.
Long, long flight also.
Yeah.
All day?
Probably on Lockheed Lodestar or something like that, anyway.
Oh.
It would be so hot, you know, that at breakfast served in the hotel, there was a very buxom German young woman and I mean she was really hefty, with a great deal of bear flesh, and invariably she'd slap the fried eggs down on the plate and in the midst of a shower of perspiration.
Oh, no.
So you never had to salt your eggs. I tell you, that place was primitive.
Mm. This is in Port Hedland.
Port Hedland.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Mm.
It had an outdoor theater. And it was at that theater the first time I saw Aborigine cowboys. What do they call them out there? Something or other. But they're barefooted with spurs on their heels.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Bare heels. Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, after the mine started, of course, then Port Hedland grew and became a more of a modern town, but in those days, it was pretty primitive.
Who were you meeting with there?
Well, I think our geology folks were out there having drilled and mapped the Goldsworthy ore body. That's the principal reason for my being out there. And at the same time, we had some civil engineering decisions to make, like bridges to build across intermittent waterways. We had to dig a channel. Had to locate an island, locate the ship loading facilities on an island just off Port Hedland.
Hmm.
I had an amusing experience. We hired the man who had been the dean of engineering when I came back from World War II and went back to Berkeley, O'Brien. O'Brien was, his expertise was literal movement along, the movement of tides and sand along coastline. Marcona had used him as a consultant when they built a shipbuilding facility in Peru. We hired him to help us develop the port plan for Port Hedland.
Mm-hmm.
And, I may have said this before.
You did, but you had thrown away your test.
Yeah. He did a good job for it. Got the channel pointed in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a big construction job that you
did. Yeah, it was. And Utah had dredges, brought a dredge over from Japan to dredge the channel. And Utah did the construction work.
Was that their first construction job there? No, they'd been there.
Been there for a long time.
Since 1950,
yeah.
That's right. This was after all their other work. So they already had crews and everything there to bring over. Yeah. Were you meeting at that time with any Western Australia government people, or?
At that time, probably not, but later,
mm-hmm.
later, yes. We had a great deal to do with the state government, of course, having
mm-hmm.
(clears throat) been a successful tenant and then developing a lease. And I came to know the premier of Australia quite well.
The
pretty
premier?
Nice guy. Huh?
Of Western Australia?
Western Australia, yeah.
Court?
Who?
Is it Court?
Yeah, Charles Court.
What did you do with him?
What do we do with him?
Maybe I shouldn't word it that way. What relationship did you have with him?
Oh, very cordial one. I'm trying to think back now. By this time, Bev was traveling with me. She'd get over there. I think we would go out to dinner. When we were in Perth, we'd go to dinner with the courts. And,
Your children were old enough that you could leave them then?
My mother would stay with the children. My mother would come here. This house.
That was nice.
Yeah.
You had built this house by then. When did
we
you
build it? In 1960.
60.
Moved in 61.
I see. And your mother could come up and babysit.
Mother would. She loved that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ooh, nice for you too. Because you were on the go a lot.
Yeah, by that time we were developing the coal in Queensland.
Okay.
Between working with the Queensland state government and the Japanese on the contract, I spent a lot of time out there.
Had you been to Japan before this?
I went over with Japan with Chuck Robinson at a Goldsworthy joint venture meeting or something in Tokyo. Probably in 61.
Chuck Robinson and Goldsworthy?
No, I don't mean Goldsworthy, I mean Marcona.
Marcona.
Yeah. You could say that was my first trip there.
Mm-hmm. What was that like? How are we doing?
I think we ought to use this. The coal development in Queensland is so important to Utah's future. I think we ought to save that for separate.
Yes, I think so too. But just in preparation, I was thinking of your introduction to Australia and your introduction to Japan.
You know, the first trip I made to Australia, that's out to Goldsworthy. I'd had such a miserable time in Goldsworthy. You know, the food was awful. At this hotel that I mentioned, we would, they'd make sandwiches for us to take out, and we went out to the exploration camp. The sandwiches were white bread with canned spaghetti.
Oh, no.
God, it was terrible. And I got back to Melbourne, and forgotten the name of the hotel now, but there was a bookstore there, and prominently displayed in this bookstore was a book entitled A Treasury of Australian Cooking. And there was a little, kind of an elderly lady running this bookstore. And I saw that, and it just struck me as being so comical. I told her that I knew Australian cooking was bad, but I didn't know that they had to study books to make it that way. And she didn't speak to me for 2 weeks.
No.
The whole time there, she thought I was terrible.
You didn't buy the book for Beth.
I didn't buy the book.
You have a lot of beans on toast and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
striking eggs.
No, that was not out in Port Hedland. They didn't go that far. I don't think they had any steak. They had a lot of, that was a sheep country, mm-hmm. so they had a lot of mutton there.
Mm-hmm. Beer.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking it must be a tremendous adjustment to be dealing with both Australians and the, and Japanese, because their cultures are so very different.
It kind of, it was fun, you uh-huh. know, in a lot of respect. I had, you know, George Ishiyama, whom I mentioned as having been involved in the Argonaut ironware mm-hmm. sale to Japan. Was by this time, when we began to develop an interest in coal, and we retained Ishiyama to be our advisor in Japan. And Ishiyama kind of introduced me, and Keith Wallace was working with me at that time, to Japanese business ethics. And we would, when we'd come over, we'd take a suite in the Palace Hotel Annex, and George would spend all evening talking to us about how to do business in Japan. It was quite an education.
This was in the Palace Hotel in Tokyo.
In Tokyo, yeah.
Tell me about George Ishiyama. Was he, what was his background?
UCLA graduate. Mm-hmm. His father was, father and mother, Los Angeles, and I think they were in the antique business, so they sold antiques. And George graduated from UCLA in business administration, I think it was. And about that time, the war came along, and George was swept up along with his, by this time I think his parents were dead, but along with everybody else, and interned in the Santa Anita racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And George told me that he was working in a service station, pumping gasoline there. And he had word that the FBI wished to speak with him. So he trudged into the FBI office at Santa Anita Racetrack, and he said, the fellow sitting behind the desk said, we want some help from you. We need help in understanding the inscrutable Oriental. George said it. He told the fellow, hell, he didn't know the inscrutable Oriental. He was born and raised in Los Angeles, went to L.A. City College, and then UCLA. He didn't know anything about the inscrutable Oriental. George became the chief procurement officer for the Japanese internment camps out in Wyoming and Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the travel priority of a colonel in the army.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it often he would, not often, but occasionally he'd be going someplace and he'd bump a lesser military person. And he said it was really quite amusing. They really got upset about it. Here's this Japanese fella bumping him off the airplane. But in his role as procurement officer for the camps, and you know, there were several hundred thousand Japanese mm-hmm. interned out there, so there was a lot of food buying. And George met people in the, on the sales side of companies who later became the heads of companies. And George was on a first name basis with the head of Procter & Gamble and, you know, all sorts of pretty interesting career. And out of that, then, he started in Japan with his Takahashi, left Takahashi, went on his own, and through relationships that he'd developed on both sides of the ocean, developed quite a profitable business and being the, really the go-between between the American side and Japanese side.
So he did speak good Japanese at this
point.
Was Takahashi the one that had those import stores?
No, different Takahashi.
Different,
yeah. It might be the same family, at least I'm not sure.
So he was in a unique position.
Yeah, he was, and he did. He did a good job. He did a very good job for us.
How did the first contact with Christensen come, do you know?
Well, that was through Takahashi and I think it was Takahashi who was seeking sources of iron ore and met with Christensen and bought some two or three shiploads of iron ore from Cedar City, Utah. And then out of that grew the Argonaut thing.
And Ishiyama was working for Takahashi.
Yeah.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And they were involved in the early stages of the Marcona iron ore sales.
Mm-hmm.
Later, Robinson took that over, took it away from them.
So. What instructions did he give you for dealing with the Japanese?
Oh, not instructions, but just
education.
Really, just understand the there's some fundamental differences in between the Japanese and we Americans, stemming in great part from the differences in society.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a very interesting education, very interesting time for me.
Mm-hmm. Great challenge.
That was a lot of fun, you know, because it was the fun that I had in that business was successfully identifying investment opportunities that created wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, boy, that, to me, that was the name of the game. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was just a lot of fun. As we were doing this in a, at a time when it was pretty easy. Because the whole world, you know, was reconstructing, being reconstructed after devastation of World War II, Japan, and Europe, and the demand for basic raw materials was insatiable. And given a good ore deposit, coal deposit, you could just pretty well name your price, and that, a lot different now.
Well, those were heady times.
Yep. Well. Why don't we go, we'll launch into this Queensland coal business. Next session.
Okay, I think that probably is a good idea. Although we get good momentum going after a while here too, but there's, we can't, that's gonna